Mr. Sheldon, we've got 5 minutes for you for rebuttal, and whenever you'd like to begin, sir.
Thank you, John Sheldon, for Robert Stultz. Robert Stultz is serving a 5-year sentence for computer solicitation of a minor when it appears not only possible, but likely that the jury also found that he correctly believed his target was an adult. And that happened in Virginia because Virginia stands alone in U.S. jurisdictions in having a statute that allows a mens rea of reason to believe that would allow a conviction in this case for a target that could possibly believe for a defendant where his target could be an adult. It's not Virginia in the entirety that stands alone using this mens rea. It's only part of Virginia because at least one circuit court, and I suspect several, have seen the difficulty with this language, reason to believe, and has done what a circuit court in Fairfax has done, which has said reason to believe means the defendant subjectively believes. So at least one circuit court in Fairfax has done that. No other jurisdiction in the United States has a mens rea as loose and as enabling a conviction of this type as Virginia.
Mr. Sheldon, does it make a difference that the jury was instructed about reason?
No, Your Honor. The instruction on reason, as I discuss in the brief, reason has, it's a noun with two different meanings, completely separate. One is causation. That instruction, if given, could have been helpful, might have assisted the jury. In this case, the reason instruction given to the jury was on the faculty of the mind. And the faculty of the mind is a definition of reason, but it did not assist the jury in any way in answering the question of whether this defendant believed the target was a minor or an adult. And if you ask the question, could the jury have found that the defendant thought subjectively his target was an adult and still found a reason to believe? And then you look at that faculty of the mind instruction, which really, for me, is a little bit mind-boggling. It's a little, you know, it defines faculty of the mind. And it doesn't assist me in any way, and I doubt it assisted the jury. And I entirely doubt that it prevented the jury from both finding he, Stultz, believed his target was an adult, and found that there was a reason for him to believe the target was a minor. That is, the detective said over and over, I'm 13. So it's true that that instruction was given on faculty of the mind, but it in no way resolved the constitutional issue, the unconstitutional application of this statute through that jury instruction in this case. It in no way prevented the problem we're faced, which is that a jury can believe a defendant had a subjective intent to target an adult and still find him guilty of a crime which carries a minimum of 5 years. Stated another way, because the jury could have found that Stultz himself did not believe the target was a minor and still convicted him, because the detective gave him a reason to believe. The detective said over and over, I'm 13. No matter how frivolous or silly the reason seems, in light of the fact that he also saw a picture of an adult, he also spoke to an adult on the phone, in light of all that, the jury was still allowed to convict him because of this mens rea, which is not only rare, but it really stands alone in the United States as a mens rea in criminal cases. We go through in our brief the history of not allowing strict liability or even a negligence mens rea in criminal cases. And, of course, there are public welfare offenses of which it should be absolutely clear this is not one. This is not a public welfare offense. It's too serious. It has too much stigma on a defendant. It carries a mandatory minimum of 5 years. It is not one of those few cases that we allow strict liability, those few cases like statutory rape where we are willing to put on a defendant the burden of knowing, not believing, knowing the facts because the defendant in statutory rape meets the person. This is not that kind of case at all. We cannot have strict liability. We can't have negligence in a computer solicitation case. We have to have a mens rea, which requires, as hundreds of years of history in our country requires, that the defendant himself have a culpable state of mind, a culpable one meaning subjective intent to commit this crime, and he didn't. In McDonald, McDonald is a perfect analogy for the analysis that this court should undertake. The court concluded that the instruction defining official act for McDonald, and you all are familiar, obviously, without even reading the case, the facts of McDonald, but the problem with McDonald's conviction is the definition of official act. The court defined official act, but too broadly. And the U.S. Supreme Court said the question when an element of the offense is defined too broadly is whether it is possible that the jury could have found on the facts presented that that the defendant engaged in lawful conduct but still convicted him. Is it possible? Could the jury have? And the U.S. Supreme Court readily said in McDonald, McDonald could be convicted under a proper definition of official act and will send this case back. But they said because the possibility of this broad definition of official act, the possibility that the jury could have convicted McDonald despite the fact that he didn't engage in any illegal behavior because his official act could have been simply a meeting or phone call, which should not be illegal, we're sending this back for a new trial under the proper definition. That's what should happen in this case. Because there is a possibility under all the facts that Stultz was convicted for protected conduct, that is, without having a subjective intent to target a minor, the jury absolutely could have. Just look at their question. Their question should resolve this issue for this court. Absolutely. The jury comes back asking the question that would be immediately obvious to anybody that looks at this jury instruction. Does the reason, based on these facts, he looks at a 25-year-old, he speaks to a 39-year-old, and the argument of the prosecutor in closing is, but he had a reason. The detective said 13. So the jury comes back after being instructed that because the defendant had a reason he should be found guilty, the jury comes back with the question that one would think any 12 people would come back with. Does the reason have to be credible? Trial counsel says yes. Trial counsel says yes again. There's some discussion about what to be done, and the court says go back and read your instructions. That jury question should make absolutely obvious that not only is it possible that Stultz was convicted under an unconstitutional application of the mens rea, but that it's highly likely he was. It's highly likely that this jury, and I understand that this court is not going to put much weight into our later juror interviews where they clearly thought, I understand that, but clearly a jury could think, and highly likely did in this case, that Mr. Stultz did not believe the target was a minor.
So your contention is it's unconstitutional as applied?
As applied, yes. I'm not reaching the facial challenge at all. As applied to this case. And look at what the Fairfax judge did in Bagot, the short one-page opinion. The judge said, look, to make this constitutional, it's got to be that the defendant himself had a subjective belief. This statute, instead, in Fairfax, the judge said, this statute is constitutional because we're going to interpret it into a constitutional application. And we're going to say reason to believe means, in this case, the defendant subjectively believes. That's what the Fairfax judge did. That's what this court should do. This court should say, as applied, leaving a mens rea, which did not comport with any of our history of finding, of requiring that a defendant himself have a culpable state of mind. Just didn't in any way. And seeing how it was applied in this case, all we're asking for is the very narrow remedy that, as applied to Stultz in this case, that jury instruction should have been amended to make clear that the jury needs to find the subjective intent of the defendant. That's it. It's very narrow. And in fact, it's so narrow that I can imagine that many defendants won't even ask for reason to believe to be redefined. Some may, some won't. This issue does not arise when the target is in fact a minor. When the target is in fact a minor, this isn't an issue at all. When the defendant has an overwhelming belief that the target is a minor, but it's a detective, it may not arise in that case either. You might have so much discussion that the court is overwhelmingly convinced that this defendant believes the target is a minor, but not on these facts. On these facts, as applied, with such overwhelming evidence that the target could have been an adult, it's this application.
How do you deal with the situation, though, that the fact finder here could have believed when he went to the garden center I mean, it drew him there.
That's right.
That why couldn't the fact finder reasonably come to a conclusion that he thought it was more likely that it was a mine?
That's right. I thought it was
rebuttal.
Red. It's yellow.
That's
now.
All right.
So the two answers to that. First is that that's not the standard we're reviewing. The standard we're asking is it possible the jury could have applied this statute unconstitutionally? Or, like your jury instruction cases, where if a defendant proffers a jury instruction that is rejected, you look at the facts in the light most favorable to the profferer of the instruction. But more so, could the jury have? Yes. But that's like a sufficiency of the evidence argument, and it's not really relevant to the constitutional question. But if we did want to answer the Constitution, if we did want to answer what did the jury find, remember that the jury found Mr. Stultz not guilty of attempted indecent liberties. It is strong evidence that the jury misinterpreted and the jury's not at fault. I mean, look at this instruction. Misinterpreted the instruction reason to believe to allow a conviction even though Stultz subjectively believed his target was an adult. The fact that he went to the Garden Center, they found him not guilty of attempted decent liberties. The difference between attempted indecent liberties and the computer solicitation, virtually the only difference, the mens rea. Attempted indecent liberties requires a mens rea of knowingly or intentionally attempting to do the same list of items in computer solicitation. The jury found him not guilty. So taking the analysis as we should, which is it possible the jury could have applied this unconstitutionally, then it seems obvious that they could have. And could the jury have found him guilty, or could they, on remand, find Stultz guilty? Yes, absolutely they could. But it's not the analysis to go forward with to find for us in this case.
And do you want to reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I think that this is a case that can be easily disposed of without getting into any constitutional questions, although on the merits we certainly submit that there's no constitutional error here, whether it's on the basis of invited error, reprobate, inconsistent positions, procedural default, they all come out in the wash in the same manner. I think it was Judge O'Brien that asked what about the significance that the jury was instructed in this case on reason. And, of course, the challenge term here is reason to believe. And counsel gave this elaborate answer about there are two kinds of reason. The problem for him and the defense is that is, at this point, beside the point. If you look at pages 631 and 632 of the appendix, and it's somewhat ironic for presently the Commonwealth opposed this instruction that the defense submitted, and frankly the fact that the court gave it makes this court's task much simpler. The defense had challenged the phrase reason to believe, so defense counsel submitted an instruction that the court gave over the Commonwealth's objection in which it said reason is a factuality of the mind by which it distinguishes truth from falsehood, good from evil, and which enables the processor to deduce inferences of facts or from propositions. Defense attorney goes on to say at page 631, so I don't believe reason or have a reason to believe is defined, and brings up again these far-fetched hypotheticals along the lines of, if I tell your honors I'm 7 feet tall, weigh 450 pounds, and I'm 33 years old. According to the defense's notion, that means there's a reason to believe, which reads the word reason out of the English language as far as I'm concerned. But be that as it may, defense counsel, who had complained about this reference to reason to believe and not being defined, so he's explaining why he sought the instruction. And he says at the top of page 632, but if he doesn't have a reasonable belief in, and the statute says reason to believe, and so I defined reason. Clear implication is, in order to alleviate any problems, I'm submitting this instruction, which the court gave. Then you get to the jury question, and again, defense counsel takes a very similar tack. When the question from the jury was, does he have to find the reason credible in order to have reason to believe? So there's a back and forth between the judges, the judge and the counsel as what kind of answer to give. Defense counsel quite clearly proposes and agrees with the trial court that we should refer the jury to the instructions, and defense counsel says at page 832 of the appendix, does he have to find it reasonable or credible? I would say yes. In order to have reason to believe, it's got to be a credible reason. But, and alluding to his instruction that's been given, reason is a faculty of the mind by which it distinguishes truth from falsehood, good from evil, which enables the processor to deduce inferences from facts or from propositions. Judge then says, I mean, we gave them the definition of reasonable. Commonwealth's attorney agreed, but said, I don't know if we should point to that. Defense counsel, I would say yes would be mine. And then the court, page 833, I'm just going to tell them you've been given the instructions of law in this case in this matter. And defense counsel, yeah, please review the instruction of law, I guess. And then defense counsel says, all of the instructions, I guess, because they may be just looking at the, and the court says something which certainly minimizes the significance for your purposes of the very fact the question was posed. Defense counsel says, all the instructions, I guess, because maybe they're just looking at court. Maybe they haven't gotten to it yet. That's going to be quick. Defense counsel, yeah, real quick. The court, yeah, we gave them the definition is in there. All right, I will just say I will direct you to review all instructions of law that have been given to you in this matter. Defense counsel, please. By the way, it was a fairly lengthy jury charge, and this instruction, the one defining reason, was very near the end. So as both the court and defense counsel indicated, it was entirely possible when the question was posed, the jury hadn't even gotten to that instruction. And by the way, there was never any follow-up questions. I had a death penalty case argued in the U.S. Supreme Court where the point I made was, after an initial question about, well, how does this instruction, what does it mean? The very fact that there were no follow-up inquiries from the jury was regarded as probative of the fact that the judge's answer, which is essentially the same as here, was deemed sufficient. So, irrespective of what counsel says today, the fact is the defense, by their own description, regarded the instruction that it submitted over the objection of the Commonwealth as sufficient to elaborate on this term, reason to believe. When the jury posed its question, defense counsel absolutely agreed that the appropriate answer was to refer the jury to the instructions, which included the one defining reason. Under those circumstances, there's simply nothing for this court to review because they're shifting gears in a way that is not permitted on appeal. Again, whether you call it the two things that would occur to me, although you have four or five concepts, but the two that would leap to mind would be approbate and reprobate and invited error. So I submit that we don't even get to the issue. Now, counsel argued on brief at some length, and I guess to some degree he's resurrected it today, that there's improperly no mens rea element, and that is simply wrong. 18.2-this was under 18.2-374.3c, but 374.3b has a similar provision. And what the Supreme Court of Virginia said there, I think, plainly carries over to subsection C. It says, in Dietz, under Code Section 182374.3b, the communication establishes the actus reus component of the crime, and the purpose of the communication establishes the mens rea component, both of which must be proved to establish a violation of the subsection. So you plainly have a mens rea element in 182-374.3. I noticed, by the way, counsel filed a reply brief, said nothing about Dietz and the Commonwealth's invocation of it. Counsel says that the test here is whether there's a reasonable possibility that this instruction somehow caused the defendant to be wrongly convicted. He cites McDonald. The clear, explicit holding in the U.S. Supreme Court, starting with Boyd or Boydie versus California, it did away with the old test in Sandstrom v. Montana and some other cases talking about a reasonable juror. Boydie specific, and it, the Supreme Court in Boydie even acknowledged that some of its prior cases were not entirely in sync. So Boydie, the Supreme Court, formally adopted the test that there must be a reasonable probability that the challenged instruction had an unconstitutional effect. I submit there is nothing remotely approaching that here. And I will reiterate the Commonwealth's position, one, by the way, that the single judge in initially refusing this petition also thought was the case. This is a quasi-sufficiency of the evidence argument. Counsel says, and basically, this is an ipse dixit case. Take my word for it. I reasonably and objectively and correctly sized up from the very outset that this was a fake. The problem for him is that there was evidence overwhelmingly to the contrary. First of all, of course, the jury convicted him. But beyond that, the notion that he was this innocent but shrewd operator is, frankly, under the record in this case, fairly preposterous. By the defense's own description, this was a five-hour window of back and forth between him and Annie. He drove from his home. Well, at one point he says, I was really ticked off, really angry that these people were trying to scam me. But on the other hand, I was just fascinated by what they were doing. I can tell you, if I get some scam call at home, I'm not saying, well, you know, let me go back to what I said last hour. Any normal person wants to get rid of it. This goes on for 5 hours, and we still don't know whether he did it because he was really angry and ticked off that they were trying to scam him, or he was intrigued. He then drives, apparently, according to the record, from his home in Arlington to Burke, which is just obviously a drive of some minutes. I think at another point in the record it talks about Falls Church. And he drives there, I guess, but for reasons that are totally inconsistent. He says, this is, if you believe some of his testimony, this is multitasking to unprecedented dimensions. He said in his testimony, for example, if I can find it here, he said he went to the Walmart and he was going to buy fertilizer. This is the same Walmart in Burke that he drove to a number of minutes away. He drove there because he needed fertilizer. I mean, this is just the most fortunate congruence of circumstances, according to the defendant. He goes to the Walmart to check for fertilizer. He also harkens back to the fact that his girlfriend suggested maybe he go golfing because it was just a beautiful day and there's a nearby golf course. So I think a chance to go golfing, and this is at page 659 of the appendix, to go golfing and one of the other things. And so when they mentioned the Burke Walmart, instantly I know two things in Burke. I know the Burke Lake Golf Course because that's where we go and play golf at least once a month. And I know there's a Dairy Queen there, which is something we both love as well. Apparently, this was the top Dairy Queen in Northern Virginia, so people in Arlington would flock to go to it. I knew where the Walmart was. I figured I could, you know, kill several birds with one stone. I could go after dinner and get some ice cream and then go hit some golf balls at the driving range that they have at Burke Lake because it was a beautiful evening. What an unlucky defendant this was. The very place that they proposed to meet and where he could do all these other things somehow blew up in his face. To put it mildly, the jury could have rejected that as absurd on the face of it.
Let me get you to switch gears for just a second here. Is it your contention, then, that the jury was properly instructed and was instructed at the defendant's request?
Certainly, yes. Certainly it was properly instructed. I don't think the instruction, frankly, was required, and the failure to give it did not constitutionally invalidate the instruction. But if there was any argument to be made either way, it's been resolved by the fact the jury submitted, the defendant submitted the instruction and plainly regarded it as having some kind of efficacy. I mean, he alluded to the fact, as I've said at pages, I think, 631 and 32 of the appendix, reason to believe hadn't been denied, which is why he submitted the instruction. He obviously didn't submit it because he thought it would be ineffectual. And then when the jury asked the question, he obviously, in effect, reiterated this should take care of any concerns. I would point out, I don't have much time left, but in the Padracki case, this court on any number of occasions referred to the phrase reason to believe in rejecting constitutional challenges. Not even a hint that there was any problem in that phraseology. I've also referred the court to any number of statutes in titles 18.2 and 19.2 that use equivalent phrases. If there's a constitutional problem here, there's a constitutional problem in a lot of Virginia criminal statutes. So, again, I submit there's no reasonable probability here of of the jury misapprehending the instructions. The defendant's void for vagueness argument is not well taken, which in turn means that there's no challenge available for a facial challenge to the constitutionality. I'd ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Sheldon, can you address Padracki for
us
again?
Yes. So really, I think the easiest way to think about Padracki, on the surface I can say, look, it was a facial First Amendment challenge. And the reason why Padracki doesn't help this court at all and does not answer the question is because if you answer the question, why was it a facial challenge? It was a facial challenge because Padracki himself, the facts were, he knew his targets. And he knew they were underage. So he couldn't bring an as-applied challenge. And although opposing counsel mentions that Padracki uses the language reason to believe, they don't analyze the language reason to believe in any way. They cite the statute, so there is in one place in Padracki where the words reason to believe exist because they're citing the statute. But there's no analysis of that language for good reason. Padracki couldn't raise an as-applied challenge, didn't raise an as-applied challenge, raised only a facial First Amendment challenge, and the reason is because of his facts. He couldn't have won. And so what was the question Padracki asked? Padracki said, look, in general, when you're soliciting over the Internet, how are you supposed to know that your target is a minor when it's over the Internet? You can't, so every solicitation is unconstitutional. Does the answering of that question, which is the only question Padracki addressed, help this court at all in determining whether a jury could, using the language reason to believe, convict somebody who subjectively believed his target was an adult and the target was an adult, but still find reason to believe? Padracki just doesn't assist at all. It doesn't assist me at all. There's nothing in Padracki which helps answer that question. And again, it's for good reason, because Padracki couldn't have and didn't raise an as-applied challenge. And Padracki did not challenge in any way the language reason to believe. Padracki never said, look, this is vague, violates due process. It was a First Amendment challenge. Never said, look, I could have been convicted. Podracki never said, I could have been convicted and I could have believed my target was an adult. He didn't say that because it was so blatantly obvious. He didn't. He knew his target, and his target was a minor. So Podracki really, and it's the same answer to this, the faculty of reason instruction. The question is, could Stoltz have been, is it possible that he was convicted while having a mens rea, subjective intent of believing his target was an adult, but the jury still convict him? Yes. Was it possible? Oh my gosh, overwhelmingly. Does this reason to believe, does the Podracki case or the faculty of reason instruction give you any thought or confidence that the faculty of reason prevented the jury from convicting Stoltz when he subjectively believed his target was an adult? In no way. It doesn't help it in at all. In fact, what was interesting is even though opposing counsel spent half his time talking about faculty of reason instruction, he didn't talk about the issue in the case, mens rea. Why? Because faculty of reason does not solve the problem in this case. It does not prevent a jury. Now, there's nothing in that instruction which addresses the mens rea, which would prevent a jury from finding an individual defendant believes his target is an adult correctly and still convicting him. Nothing in it at all. The opposing counsel never talked about the objective and subjective intent requirement. He also talked overwhelmingly about sufficiency of the evidence. It's not a sufficiency of the evidence case. In fact, it's the opposite, right? We proffered instruction. The question is, look at the evidence in the light most favorable to Stoltz and ask, is there more than a scintilla of evidence supporting the fact in this case that he could have thought his target was an adult? Of course there is. And was the evidence overwhelming? Of course not. Mr. Stoltz was tried once. There was a mistrial. 10 jurors for acquittal, 2 for guilt. That doesn't sound overwhelming to me. He was found not guilty of attempted indecent liberties. There's all this talk about Burke and Walmart. But remember, the jury found him not guilty of trying to do anything. So,
Mr. Shelton, your time is up. I'll just ask if you wanted to take a minute and sum up, we're happy to hear from you.
I misread my timer. I see that it's counting. Thank you very much. We would just ask that this court find the statute unconstitutional in this very narrow instance as applied to Stoltz.
Thank you so much. We will come down and greet counsel then.